Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story of the West Memphis Three is chilling from any angle. In 1993, three eight-year-old boys gruesomely murdered in West Memphis, Arkansas. Part of a satanic ritual, police said. 1994, three teenagers tried and convicted of capital murder. The group's alleged ringleader, Damien Echols, sentenced to death. Immediately, doubts swirled around the investigation. The trial, the convictions were disputed. Then, stunningly, after nearly two decades, the men were released from prison. Freedom, sort of. This hour on Point, Damien Echols on life on and after death row. You can join the conversation. Have you heard of the West Memphis Three? Can you imagine this path? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Damien Echols joins us in a moment. First, with me from Jonesboro, Arkansas, is George Jared, crime reporter for the Jonesboro Sun. He's been covering the West Memphis Three story for 5 years, has interviewed Damien Echols and many of the other figures involved. George Jared, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Take us back to 1993. What happened, at least what was found, and then who was brought to trial?
Basically, what happened back on May 5th, 1993, Christopher Byers, Michael Moore, and Stevie Branch were playing in their neighborhood in West Memphis, Arkansas.
8 years old?
Eight years old. Mm-hmm. And they vanished. And the next day, their nude, bound bodies were found in a drainage ditch in the Robin Hood Hills area of West Memphis. Police pretty quickly developed a theory that the perpetrator of the crime was into the occultism or Satanism, and so they pretty quickly started putting together a list of teenagers in the area that they thought that might be involved in that type of activity, and Damien Echols was developed as a suspect pretty early on, and then his best friend Jason Baldwin was soon added to that list, and then finally someone that was an acquaintance of theirs, Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., was also thought of as a suspect. And then a month later, the three were arrested and charged with capital murder in the case. And subsequently, in March of 1994, Damien Echols was sentenced to death.
I've got a little tape here from back. This was in 1993, June 7th. This is from KAIT 8 News in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Jenna Newton, the reporter there. And this was included in the HBO documentary Paradise Lost, directed by Joe Berlinger and Bruce Senofsky, bringing the whole West Memphis 3 story to international attention. But here was from that early news report as the world heard about it.
According to the published report, Miss Kelly told police he watched 18-year-old Damien Echols and 16-year-old Jason Baldwin brutalize the children with a club and a knife. The report says Miss Kelly told police Echols and Baldwin raped one of the boys and sexually mutilated another as part of a cult ritual.
About as bad as it could get. And then August of last year, after all those years, here's CNN in Jonesboro, Arkansas, when Damien Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. were released from prison.
At this moment, the West Memphis Three are free men. They are just processing the paperwork with the Department of Corrections, and they will step outside of the bars of prison where they have spent their entire adult lives. This after over 18 years ago being arrested, charged, and convicted in the murders of three young boys.
George Jared, what happened in those intervening years? We're going to hear in just a moment from Damien Echols himself about life before and inside and after that imprisonment. But what happened in terms of international interest in this case and the law that led to these three walking free?
Well, basically what happened was during the before the trials and during the trials, Senofsky and Berlinger created a documentary film about the case. And in 1996, it was released. And it pretty much caused an international furor among a lot of people. The case brought against these three guys was very circumstantial, very weak, and there was really no forensic or DNA evidence that tied them to the crime. And what happened is over the intervening years, they were able to raise money, and they were able to hire better attorneys. They were able to bring in renowned forensic experts. And then in 2007, they were able to do some pretty specific DNA testing on hairs and other materials collected from the scene. And what they found is that the three guys in jail were not genetic matches for a lot of the stuff that was collected at the scene. And several witnesses in the case came forward and said that they lied on the stand and that they were coerced by police into making the statements they made. And even, you know, you earlier played the Miss Kelly, a tape where Miss Kelly admitted to being a part of this crime. Well, he recanted that statement pretty quickly, and much of the statement that he made at the time was inaccurate. And so he says that he was coerced by police into making that statement. And Echols and Baldwin have always maintained their innocence. And so a circumstantial case at best to begin with took, you know, there was a lot more holes in that case, especially after all this new scientific evidence came to light.
Damien Echols, the one who was on death row, who had been depicted as the ring leader, now walked free. But walked free, all three of them, on this so-called Alford plea, which brings them freedom, but not legal exoneration. Is that right, George?
That's absolutely correct. An Alford plea is a legal maneuver in which a person can go into court and say, I am innocent of this crime, but I admit at the same time that the state might have enough evidence to convict me in a court of law if it went back to trial. And so, you know, at first, Jason Baldwin, talked to him several weeks ago. He was very hesitant to accept the Alford plea, but in the end decided to because it was in the best interest of the other two men who were involved in the case. And so, yes, they are technically convicted of the crime, but they are free. The state admitted, even when they made the Alford pleas, that if this were to go back to trial, that is almost certain that these three men would have walked away free men.
George, you're just up the road from West Memphis in Jonesboro. Is there any possibility of a new prosecution? Is there a suspect, or is this just a mystery?
As far as the state of Arkansas is concerned right now, they have three convictions in this case. I've talked to the prosecutor about this many times. He says if there was compelling evidence to reopen the case, he would be open to doing that. At this time, there's been some speculation about, you know, a stepfather and maybe some other suspects. But as of right now, there is no active investigation by the state of Arkansas into this case. The prosecutor does take information from Damien Echols' defense team from time to time as they develop information. But as of right now, it's closed.
George Jared is crime reporter for the Jonesboro Sun there in Arkansas. George, thank you very much for joining us today.
Anytime, Tom.
With us now, from Tempe, Arizona, is Damien Echols. In 1994, at age 18, he, along with Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miss Kelly, were convicted of capital murder for the killings of 3 8-year-old boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. He was sentenced to death by lethal injection. After 18 years on death row, he was released from prison in August 2011 on an Alford plea, an unusual step in which defendants are released but not legally exonerated. Damien Echols was the subject of the award-winning three-part HBO documentary series Paradise Lost. He is a producer on the forthcoming Peter Jackson documentary, West of Memphis. He's author of the self-published memoir Almost Home, and now out with a big, new, haunting memoir of prison life and more called Life After Death. Damien Echols, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been out for a year and a month or so now?
Yes.
How is it being out after all those years in?
Well, I was in for 18 years. I was 18 when I went in, so I literally spent half of my life in prison. The past decade of that 18 years, I spent in solitary confinement. So I literally went from solitary confinement for nearly a decade to just being thrown back out into the world. For the first 2 to 3 months that I was out, I was in a state of such extreme shock and trauma that I had to be led around almost like a blind person. As time has passed, I've been out a little over a year now, and as time has passed, I come out of it slowly. I come back to myself a little more and a little more as the days pass. But it can still be hard sometimes.
How do you handle your emotions? Do you wrestle with bitterness, rage, fury, acceptance, all of the above?
Not really so much anymore. I've had a long time to adapt and adjust to the circumstances and situations. I did in the beginning, the first 2 or 3 years that I was on death row. I would wake up every morning furious from the moment I woke up, from the moment my eyes opened, just thinking, these people have no right to do this to me. I don't belong here. But the problem is, you know, that eats you alive inside. You're already in this external hell that other people are putting you through. The last thing you need is that internal hell, holding on to it. It eats you up. The Buddha, there was a quote where he compared it to drinking poison in hopes that it would kill the other person. And that's what it's like. In the end, it's not hurting anyone but yourself, so you have to let go of it. And that's what caused me to turn to meditation and energy work while I was in prison. I had to find something to find my way out of that place, that horrible, hateful, angry place.
And you found plenty who were eaten up there in prison on death row. Rise Above behind us here, Chuck D and Henry Rollins, both the supporters of the West Memphis 3 and Damien Eccles. Damien Eccles is with us today. He's out of prison. He's got a big new memoir out. It's called Life After Death, about early life, tough life, and life in prison. Damien, please stand by there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Damien Eccles, convicted of triple murder in 1994, 18 years on death row, now out and writing about his life as part of the West Memphis 3. His new memoir is Life After Death. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. A really haunting, poetic book about a haunting, but anything but sort of poetic circumstance. I guess it's all what you make of it. Lots of people heard about this from the HBO documentary Paradise Lost, three different sections of that. Here's a bit from early on. Pam Hobbs, the mother of Steve Branch, one of the three boys killed in West Memphis, interviewed for the 1996 documentary episode, spoke about her thoughts on the guilt of the West Memphis Three.
I believe they did it. And if they were to be set free on the street, then they would have to look behind their back, watch behind their back to see if Pam Hobbs wasn't following them. Because I'm just saying this as a human, you know, I believe I'd try to kill them too if they ever walked the street and I'm still alive.
According to a New York Times report from last year, Pam Hobbs began to doubt the three men's guilt after the case started receiving national, international attention. In the latest Paradise Lost episode, Purgatory, released last year, brings the story up to their release. And here's a scene where Damien Eccles, with us today, speaks in the documentary to filmmakers from prison.
These people would have gotten away with murdering me if it would not have been for what you guys did, for being there in the very beginning and getting this whole thing on tape so that the rest of the world sees what was happening. If not for that, these people would have murdered me, swept this under the rug, and I wouldn't be anything but a memory right now.
Damien Eccles in Paradise Lost, his new memoir is Life After Death. He joins us today from Tempe, Arizona. Damien, they almost did murder you figuratively in prison. I mean, the description in your book is just almost unbearable of what it's like to be there, to survive just regular death row life, let alone all the time in solitary confinement. Give us a sense of how your experience of it changed year after year.
Well, I think the number one thing, as much as we try to avoid it, the number one thing that deepens us, that makes us grow, and that makes us learn and expand as individuals is pain. And there is a lot of pain in prison. I barely even knew where to begin. It started almost as soon as I arrived in prison. The guards decided they were going to welcome me to the neighborhood, so they carried me to the part of the prison they call the hole. It's this really dark, filthy part of the prison in complete isolation, where it gets up to 120 degrees in the summer, and they can do pretty much anything they want to you. And for the next 18 days, they beat me half to death. They beat me, they starved me, they tortured me in just about every way you can torture a human being. They'd come in at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning and chain me to the bars of the cell and beat me with nightsticks. At one point, they'd beat me so bad that I started to urinate blood. It's something that'll stick with me for the rest of my life, I guess.
Did they do that, Damien, because you'd been convicted of torturing and murdering a child?
No.
We hear about this kind of prison, you know, special bad treatment for molesters. That was your conviction at the time.
They didn't care. They don't care if you're innocent. They don't care if you're guilty. They don't care what you're there for. I mean, you have to take into consideration. Have you ever heard a child say, when I grow up, I want to be a prison guard? You know, nobody wants that job. So it tends to draw like the society's lowest common denominator. You know, someone who would be attracted to brutality or attracted to these horrendous situations. Stuff like that, guilt, innocence, or anything else, it doesn't matter at all to them.
You were 18 years old at the time, so young. And you are quite a writer. We can see from your journals and from this book. Use that for us for a second here. Paint a picture of yourself at that age. You were a brooding kid. You had not had an easy childhood. Who was Damien Eccles in 1994, 1995?
Someone who grew up, even the words dirt poor don't really articulate it. When my family did finally move up into a trailer park, to us that was moving up in the world, you know, to have heat and running water and things like that. You know, to us that was just the lap of luxury. I have a ninth grade education, which is more than anyone else in my family does. My mother had me when she was 15. I believe my father was 16. You know, almost stereotypical dirt poor, illiterate Southerners, like something you would see portrayed in a really bad movie about the South. I always liked reading and writing. You know, it's one of the things I started doing when I was probably 12 years old. I started writing, and it was something I always loved, something that just scratched an itch somewhere deep inside that I couldn't get to any other way. And that was what helped me keep my sanity in part in prison, just writing the experience out as I would go along. It was an act of catharsis for me. The book, I probably wrote at least 85% of it while I was still on death row. The other 15% I wrote after I was released, but even that is mostly like editorial stuff, you know, write a little something to bridge two parts together or give a little further clarification or explanation. But the vast, vast majority of this book was written while I was in a cell on death row.
What was it about you in 1993 that let authorities or helped them pin this satanic label on you? What made you vulnerable to this characterization?
It was a few things. One was that we came from this really tiny, just hardcore fundamentalist town back in 1993 where I just didn't fit in. I was what people now call goth, but back then I'd never even heard the word before. And it just made me automatically a target in this town for people who just didn't like the way I looked. That, and also you had a sort of juvenile division of the police department that was full of really corrupt individuals. One of them was eventually sent to prison in Florida for stealing from the police department. Another one was forced to quit after he was caught molesting teenage boys. But he would come through our neighborhood and pick up teenage boys and say, either you perform sexual favors for me or you're going to jail. And they noticed me and sort of zoomed in on me, made me like their number one priority to make my life a living hell while I was there. So whenever these murders happened, it was these guys who go to the West Memphis Police Department and say, we think we've got your guy right here. This is the guy you need to look at.
You were the outcast in a way, or the outsider, and then quickly the target. Damien Eccles is with us. His memoir of life on death row before and after and 18 years during is Life After Death. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Damien, lots of callers for you. If I may, Elizabeth City, North Carolina, Ron is calling. Ron, you're on the air with Damien Eccles.
Hi. Hi, Tom. And I became familiar with this case probably about I saw a Piers Morgan interview. And I just really cannot believe what you've gone through, Damien. And the best thing about the whole situation is that you're relating. You can turn this around and expose what trauma it is to be falsely accused and to sit there and go through this. And I hope everything goes well for you, and that's the main thing that you get out of this, is just help the other people that are in the same situation.
Ron, have you been in that spot, falsely accused, in trouble?
I was an outcast teenager, just not outcast, but I was different, and you're always targeted when you're different. I was the David Lee Roth goth look all through high school, and you're just instantly, when you're notoriously different, you're notoriously a target. And it's just like there's a bullseye on you for everything. And like I said, I'm just so glad you've gotten through this, because I had some incarceration problems when I was a teenager, and it's like you're up against the wall. You can't do nothing about it. Nobody listens. It's all just a mechanical slamming of a door. It's the most isolated. It's just unbelievable, and I'm so glad that you're getting through this and you can help other people. That's my comment.
Ron, thank you. Thank you, Ron. Thank you very much for your call. Damien, did you see yourself then in prison, or do you see yourself now as a champion of the outcast realm of society?
I don't really see myself as a champion of anything, but what I would like to do is take this situation and turn it into something positive. Whenever I was in there, just, you know, one example, there's almost no medical care on death row. They're not going to spend a lot of time, money, or energy taking care of someone they plan on killing. So there were times when I was in horrendous pain, or that I got so sick that I literally thought I was not going to live through the night. And the only thing I had to rely on were the meditation techniques, the energy work techniques. What I would like to do eventually is be able to have like a small meditation center somewhere and share the same things with people that helped me survive that situation, that helped me make it through when I didn't have anything else. So, no, I don't really see myself as a champion of anything, but I would like to do something that helps people who do feel that way, like they have their back against the wall with nothing, nowhere else to turn.
I want to look at how that work, that Zen Buddhist work, came to you. But what about some of your neighbors on death row? You were not always in solitary confinement. You had neighbors. Give us a sense of the neighborhood.
Oh, it goes from one end of the spectrum to the other. The way I got into Zen was through another prisoner. As soon as I arrived on death row, this guy sends me down basic things that I would need, you know, like a paper and an envelope to write home, and a razor to shave with, all these different things. And the reason he did that is because he would put these little packages together to try to help everyone who first came into the door in prison. This guy was eventually ordained as a Zen priest before he was finally executed. He was guilty, and he took full responsibility for his crimes. And that was what led me down the road to Zen in the first place. Whenever he was executed, I met his spiritual advisor, who would come to the prison, and eventually I received ordination myself in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japanese Buddhism, which is the same tradition that used to train the samurai in ancient Japan. And that's what, you know, allowed me to cope with what we were talking about a while ago, the anger and everything else. But you have guys on death row that aren't capable of doing anything constructive in that way. They don't have the capacity. You know, the average IQ of guys on death row is only about 85. And we see this image portrayed in society, like everyone there is like this genius criminal Hannibal Lecter types, and it's just not true. You know, you had guys, they say it's illegal to execute the mentally insane, or what the law terms the mentally retarded, but it still happens on a regular basis. I think the worst, most horrific case in Arkansas was a man who had shot himself in the head and given himself a lobotomy but survived. And whenever they got ready to execute him, they ask him, "What do you want for your last meal?" And he says, "Pecan pie." So they bring him the pie, and he eats half of it. Whenever they come to execute him, he wraps the other half up and says he's going to save that until after the execution. Mm. The guy isn't even able to comprehend that they're about to kill him. You know, that's the sort of people that you're dealing with on death row for the most part.
Average IQ of 85, I don't know about that, but you may be just right. What do they think of you? I mean, you are clearly a long way from that number. Were you recognized by fellow prisoners, by guards, as an unusually smart guy in that setting? And what did they do with that recognition, if they had it?
The guards don't really care. You know, to them, intelligence means nothing. And you also have to keep in mind that I came from this community, you know, in Arkansas. It's sort of seen as into any sort of intelligence is frowned upon. You know, it's like the more ignorant you are, the more masculine you are. It's like a barometer of manhood, a lack of intelligence in a way. They see any sort of intelligence as something, really the only word I can think of is almost feminine in a way. It's something that men are to avoid at all cost. So the guards really don't care. And when
but they knew you were writing poetry. They were taking it from you. They knew that you were not an 85 IQ guy in the next cell. Did that make you a special target or just roll on?
Just roll on. You know, they've got so many people at their disposal to abuse on a daily basis that I was just one more in the mix. It didn't really mean anything to them. You know, whenever you're dealing with people like that, I think it kind of takes intelligence to recognize intelligence. People who don't have it usually don't recognize it, like a lot of things in life. And to them, it meant nothing.
Abby's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Abby, you're on the air with Damian Eccles.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, you know, Damian, I actually sent you a letter about 14 years ago, I think, after I watched Paradise Lost. I actually didn't know what it was when I rented it. I thought it was a movie, not a documentary. I think we have a lot in common. I was goth before I knew what it was, and I was very much an outcast, and there was a lot of people who thought that I was into Satanism, even though I wasn't religious at all. And I was overjoyed to hear that you were released, although I think it's an insult to how they made you take that Alfred plea in order to release you.
Sympathy there from Abby, who was writing you years ago, Damian. Abby and many others. What about the plea? Do you feel insulted at having taken it, had to take it to get out?
It is insulting. It's incredibly insulting. But at the same time, you know, people ask me, why did you take it? Why didn't you keep fighting? And the answer is because I was dying. Whenever the DNA started coming back in that started pointing towards other people, and whenever the eyewitnesses started coming forth and everything else, it seemed like there was this huge break in the case. Well, the prosecutor, what they came to us and said, in essence, is, yeah, if we go back to court, you're going to win this. You're going to go home. But we can drag this out for another 5 years, another 10 years. We can appeal every decision. We can ask for extensions. This can go on for a long time. Or you can sign this agreement, and you can go home this week. You know, I had gotten so sick at points in prison that I didn't think I was going to make it through the night. I was losing my eyesight. I wasn't doing well at all. I also knew in the documentary that we have coming out in December, the prosecutor did an interview, and he says that one of his considerations in this deal was the fact that me and the other two guys collectively could have sued the state for about $60 million. I knew they could have me stabbed to death for $50 any day of the week. Happens in prison all the time. If I didn't take that deal, I wasn't going to live to see the outside of those walls.
Damian Eccles, please stand by. The new memoir is Life After Death. West Memphis 3 became a cause celeb. We'll hear about that. 2006, Damian Eccles wrote the lyrics to Army Reserve on the Pearl Jam 2006 album. Army Reserve behind us right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Damian Eccles, convicted of triple murder in 1994, 18 years on death row, now out and writing about his life as part of the West Memphis Three. Joins us today from Tempe, Arizona. He's written a big new memoir about prison life before, after. It's called Life After Death. Damian, I'm hearing how little schooling you had, the background you came from. I'm reading what you've written here, and it's quite wonderfully written, and we're listening to you right here. Where did you get your sort of lucid grasp of the language, first of all? Never mind, you know, the way you describe the world. Where did that come from? What was your model? What was your path to that?
Honestly, as odd and bizarre as it may sound, it was Stephen King novels. I started reading Stephen King when I was very young, you know, like maybe 10 or 11 years old even. And from the very first book I ever read of his, I was hooked. And I used to read them over and over and over, so much so that in prison, you know, the characters in his stories start to seem like old friends. And the only thing I can compare it to is whenever you listen to music and you hear a beat to the music, well, whenever I read, I can sort of detect something that I can only call a beat mm-hmm. to the author's way of writing. Well, I read Stephen King novels over and over to the point where that beat became sort of ingrained into my head. So when I started to write, I wrote to match that beat. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way I can say it. I learned to write by reading Stephen King novels. Whenever I got out, one of the things that I did was look up the self-published memoir that I had put out while in prison on Amazon just to see some of the customer reviews, what they had written. Mm-hmm. And I see this one woman had written this review where she says, the whole time I'm reading this, I kept having this nagging sensation that I've heard this voice somewhere before. And then halfway through the book, I realized it's Stephen King. And to me, that was like the ultimate compliment. Even though we don't write about the same things, he writes fiction, I write nonfiction. You know, it's in no way similar. Still, she was able to pick up that thread, that beat that runs through it. And I thought that was an incredibly complimentary thing to say.
What was it like being in prison in such down and awful circumstances? You know, whether it's the solitary confinement or the heat or you name it, everything, the cruelties there, with no end in sight. And at the same time, on the outside, knowing that you had become this cause celeb with HBO documentaries about your case and Johnny Depp and Eddie Vedder and Henry Rollins and Peter Jackson with the Lord of the Rings movies. They're all sort of campaigning for you. I think at this point you've got matching tattoos with Johnny Depp. You did a book signing, what was it, just the other night with him in New York. But when you were in prison, what was it like to have these two worlds? I mean, not to mention your marriage to Laurie Davis. You had a wife on the outside who you met and married while you were in prison. What was it like to live both of those realities?
It's almost like you don't really live both of those realities. You hear about it, but it's like something on the news that happens on the other side of the world. You know, you hear it, you think about it for a second, but you're so busy trying to survive your own day-to-day life that, you know, you don't really have time to sit and ponder it. It starts out in a lot of ways as celebrity support, but it grew to be so much more over the years. You know, Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam used to come to the prison and sit with me and visit while I was on death row. It's not like these guys, you know, just threw money at it or made it a cause celeb and then moved on to the next thing. I mean, these guys became friends. Johnny Depp has become like a brother to me over the years. And it didn't stop whenever we got out of prison. You know, when I left Arkansas, the day I got out, I left like a refugee. I didn't have a penny in my pocket. I didn't have a change of clothes. I didn't even have anywhere to go. And if it wasn't for these guys catching my wife and I like a safety net, keeping us from drowning, I don't know what we would have done.
Let's go to Mark in Montreal, Canada. Mark, you're on the air with Damien Eccles.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Damien. It's a pleasure. I've been following the Westminster 3 since the first documentary came out, and I've always, as a psychoanalyst, a psychologist, wanted to know from Damien's perspective to what degree his experiences with the legal system and in prison confirmed, in a way, his earlier seemingly life view that, you know, life was or the world was depriving, morally myopic, and kind of desiccated from a point of mindfulness and equanimity.
I mean, that goth view that he had as a teenager.
Yes.
Well, I guess what I took from the situation, what I learned from going all this, is that I don't want to give in to that view. Yeah, it may seem that way sometimes. Looking around, it may seem as if the world is bleak and desolate and morally bankrupt. But you can change that. You don't have to let that be your life. You can choose to bring magic into your own life, to not have this mundane, mediocre, horrible existence. And that's what I came away from the situation with. I came away from it realizing how precious and how short life really is, and that I don't want to settle for those things. I want something better. I want something more beautiful. I want something more artistic. I want something more magical. So I would say that in a way it didn't deepen that view of life for me. In a way it made me see that that's a choice. That's an option. And it's an option that I don't want.
Did you, in all those years, did you, I mean, that sounds very Zen, and beyond Zen, maybe, if there's such a thing, but did, and enlightened, but I wonder if you came close to losing it in the other direction at some point in prison, maybe losing your sanity or losing that equanimity that Mark calls about from Montreal.
Yeah, I think any sort of equanimity or anything else that I have developed gradually over the years. I think it maybe it also helps just for some odd reason. The more nervous I get, the more calm I seem. But there was a lot of times when I did go the other direction in the beginning. You know, whenever you reach this point where you feel like you just can't hang on anymore. You know, if you've been beaten senseless, or if you've been starved, or you've been subjected to something particularly foul on some day, and you think I can't get up again. I can't keep doing this again. I mean, there are times when you just want to lay down on the floor and give up. That's when you have to look even closer, even harder, and dig a little more for some sort of beauty. You have to ask yourself, what is it I love? What is it that means something to me? What is it I want to achieve in life? And you have to dedicate yourself to that. You have to strive toward that instead of focusing on those things.
But you had no idea you'd ever be out of that cell.
No, I didn't. I didn't at all. You have to, even in that situation, as hard as it is, you have to find something to live for that's not looking towards the future. You know, you can't live every day in this hope that maybe one day you're going to get out of here or you will go nuts. You have to somehow dig out a life for yourself.
I mean, you had desperate neighbors there. I mean, what, the scotch taping crickets to their face, and you name it. I mean, who had lost it in different directions.
Yes, absolutely. I saw, you know, you would see a guy that one day he seems like he's okay, but then the next day he finally snaps and he just starts beating the walls until his fists are broken and bloody, and he's screaming that the devil is in his cell, and they'll take him out, bandage his fists up, and throw him right back in the cell. You know, you see people in there all the time that lose it.
Let's go to Dee Dee in Nashville, Tennessee, if we can. Dee Dee, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Damian Eccles.
Yes, sir. I would like to say that I totally empathize with Damian Eccles about the quality of the prison guards and that mentality of some of those people. I had occasion to work in an intake center, which is not even close to being in a death row facility, but there was just kind of an ignorant brutality of some of these folks. And I wanted also to say that I saw so many mentally challenged people that shouldn't have even been in prison, many that needed to be there, but there was many that didn't need to be there. And my heart breaks for these mentally ill folks. And I just want to say I'm sure there's a collective consciousness out there of people in this world that really are so very sorry for what Damian Eccles has had to endure. And my heart also says to you, I am so proud and happy, and I want to emulate what you've done to transcend those awful circumstances. And that's just my point.
Thank you, Dee Dee.
Thank you.
Damien, if we may, Damien, and one more, Richfield, Illinois. Dee Dee, thank you so much. Bill in Richfield, Illinois, you're on the air. Hello, Bill, are you there, my friend?
You have 9 hours and 5 minutes.
Oh, hello, Bill, have you got your phone in your hand?
No. Hello?
Hello, Bill, you're on the air.
Oh, it's Joe, actually.
Sounds like Bill's got the radio going and the phone as well. Allison, Narragansett, Rhode Island. Allison, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Damian, I'm so glad to be able to talk to you today. I, too, was ostracized in my high school years, and I was into the punk scene from having a very violent childhood upbringing. And I thought that was a good place, and it made sense for a long time, and I was bashed and treated horribly and beaten up and all these ridiculous things for being different. And I, too, have gotten into yoga and sort of Buddhist philosophies and all these different things in my later years to deal with all the pain and the struggle that I've dealt with as a child. And I just think that you're an inspiration. I know you don't think of yourself as a champion, but you really are. And when I heard about your case, I gave some money to your legal fund, and I've cried with the documentaries, and I felt for you and felt so connected to all of you so much. It easily could have been me. And I think you're incredible, and the way that you've come through this is an inspiration personally to me.
Thank you, Allison. Damien, yes, did you feel minds like Allison's and Dee Dee's on the outside reaching out to you, just that collective consciousness Dee Dee was talking about it when you were on the inside?
You do, but you don't realize how many people felt that way until after I was out and started hearing people say that, you know, just on a daily basis. Because in there, I mean, you do get some of it. You do receive letters from people. You do hear from people who say that. But at the same time, it's sort of outweighed just by the sheer brutality of the daily life you're going through. You know, it's one of those things when we were talking a while ago about just the way you choose to view life, and the reason I didn't want to be like that. Mm. And I guess it was because I would see the administration in the prison, you know, the prison guards who had just sort of gone dead behind the eyes. And I didn't want to be that way. You know, I thought, to me, that's the worst kind of hell you could possibly be in, is to be like the people who were doing this to me. So it made me strive even harder to go in the other direction. But it's, you know, even now it means so much hearing stuff like that from people. It makes you feel that everything you went through for almost 20 years wasn't completely in vain.
Damien, when you were through your Zen work and your energy work, as you call it, meditating in prison and all the rest, and clearly you were surmounting these circumstances somehow in some way. Did that lead, were the guards aware of that? Did it lead them to admire you? Did it lead them to hate you?
Once again, you know, they don't care. If they see you doing something like meditating in your cell or something, they would probably just make fun of you at the most. Stuff like that just plays no role in their world. In their eyes, it's something that's like a joke. It's insignificant. To them, the only thing in the world that matters, really what it comes down to, you're dealing with a kind of people that have sort of even lost all personality, and they've become nothing but this bundle of the most base human desires and tendencies, you know, greed, rage, lust, all of these things bundled up in a skin without a personality even to be there to give it any sort of redeeming factor anymore. So anything that strives for anything out of that, they have no appreciation for at all.
I wonder in all that meditation if you didn't sometimes reach out to them, though, as well. I mean, they were humans. They're also in there. Dan in Chesapeake, Virginia. Dan, you're on the air with Damien.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your experience, Dan?
I am a retired prison guard, and I came away from the prison business with one really intact, I guess you would call it, characteristic that I appreciate more than anything else. I am still empathetic.
Bless you.
Not all prison guards were low IQ. I often fought for inmates' rights and defended them when the system was abusing them. The prison system is a big business, and the taxpayers and the people of the United States need to take a good hard look at how many prisons we're going to continue building and funding, and how many more Americans we're going to lock up. It's out of control.
Dan, credit to you for your perspective and the empathy that you sustained even there. Our time is short, but I appreciate your call, Damien. There's that human voice of the retired prison guard saying,
absolutely,
we're all in this together in some weird way.
Absolutely. And being in the perspective of being in prison, you do appreciate that when it comes through. And you do see guards come through sometimes that try to treat you like human beings. And unfortunately, when the other guards see that happen, they usually would turn on that guard and try to make their life a living hell, try to make them quit, try to get them fired. You know, it was like, it was just insane watching something like that. Usually whenever you had somebody that did show some sort of, you know, kindness or empathy or something, they would automatically turn on them and they wouldn't last long at all.
I read that you now live with your wife, Lori Davis, in Salem, Massachusetts, of all places. I mean, yes. I guess you could have gone anywhere. Here's a place with this, and you had your goth period. Here's Salem with its witch history. Is that why you're there?
I think I loved it so much just because it's sort of, you know, the history that it does have, everything that happened there, it's sort of given them an air of tolerance that you don't find in very many places. It's one of the few places in the world where I'm actually in the majority.
Damien Eccles, out of prison, in the majority in Salem, Massachusetts. His new memoir is Life After Death. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mr. Eccles, congratulations on being out, on surviving, on your memoir, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Damien Eccles, author of Life After Death. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Here's The Blackness in the Forest. Michael Graves and Damien Eccles. Graves, formerly of the rock band Misfits, released the album Illusions with Damien in 07. He's wired up. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.